完璧などありえない。この世界は不完全だから、美し
い。もうバカバカバカ。
なに、
俺は海賊王になる。
なんて、なんて恋しさなど。
力を渡した時に言ったことを覚えているかい。クレ、違う、そこじゃない。
変態遅い。
Hello and welcome to More Than Hentai, a podcast that is here to show that anime is more than just tentacles and cat girls. There's also countless stories of love, loss, laughs, hope, horror, and happiness that are just dying to be found. And I, Brendan White, the Salt and Pepper Senpai, I'm here to help you find them. More Than Hentai is proudly powered by our friends over at Audio Technica and Dash Water. Go upgrade your audio and hydration games today over with those fantastic, fantastic brands. And joining me on this episode is a man who I met through the magic of podcasting approximately 8 years ago now. He might have temporarily retired from the podcasting game, but you can still see him doing his thing over on Twitch a couple of nights a week. From an anime standpoint, he and I are in lockstep with our tastes and our favorites, with bangers such as Violet Evergarden, Fullmetal Alchemist, Kaguya-sama Lover's War, and many, many more among his favorites. You can find him on them socials at Thunder Mace, which is T-H-U-N-D-E-R-M-A-C-E. Paul, welcome to the Riverside Shooting, my friend. How might you be doing?
Oh, hello. Oh, I'm not doing too badly. Thanks for doing all the work for the socials for me.
Hey, it's the very least I can do. You're taking time out of your busy schedule here to riff with me in the Riverside Studio. So, mate, all I'm here to do is, validate the truths and the knowledge that you share out there, and I'm hopefully been able to propagate listeners your way to see all the very good things you do. And maybe we could start with that. We sort of get a little bit of the Paul background story, who you are, what you do. Like I sort of alluded to, you did some podcasting for Ive, had to step away for a little bit, but at the same time, you're still managing to keep up that content creation game with streaming over on Twitch. But yeah, give us the Paul, aka Thunder Mace, background story.
Look, in background-wise, as you've mentioned, I used to be on podcasts called The Controllables, where we sort of just talked about weekly gaming news and just, like, it was fun friends chatting. I've had to step away because I look after my mum at home, and she hasn't been so well. So, you know, more time dedicated to her, which goes along the sides of, like, I'm more or less casually on, you know, these social networks and even Twitch. Like, if I can get maybe one night a week, I consider myself very casual and I just want to do it just more or less. Like, if someone comes in just to hang in and chat, I'm not looking to, you know, make any careers or anything out of it. It's all just hobbies to me.
No, I love that. And I think that's a healthy, you know, realistic mindset to have with content creation in general, whether you want to be a streamer or a podcaster or athlete, whatever it is. Like, I think you need to have that type of relaxed mindset where I'm going in, I'm having fun, I want to have good conversations with good people, and, you know, whatever happens off the back of that, great. Instead of like, I'm going in and I'm going to become ninja by the end of the month. Like, no, that's not realistic. That doesn't happen. So yeah, just be grounded in your goals and just be open to whatever will present itself with you. And you've been playing a good assortment of games. You've got a couple of good hobbies and genres that you get into that I'm a big fan of. I know you are all about Hunt for a good long while. Are you still playing? Like, I've jumped off the Hunt wagon, to be honest, not through lack of appreciation of the game. It's a ton of fun, but I think just that loop got a little tired for me and there's so much else out there. But are you still out there killing big beasties in that first-person sort of period shooter?
I am. I can say Hunt Showdown is still currently my favorite multiplayer game to go play when I've got the mood to. So I still play it at least probably, I say probably 3 times a week at minimum. Okay. I just hit last week 1,000 hours. And for me, that's a very impressive. I've played a multiplayer game for that long. So to me, that speaks volumes of, like, I just love Hunt Showdown.
It certainly, it shows that, not the bug, but maybe the evil nightmare fuel-y bosses or like zombie based creatures have certainly bitten you and it's sunk in and you can't get enough Hunt Showdown.
Oh yeah. And I think in comparison to most modern multiplayer shooters like Call of Duty and stuff, where it's a lot more Twitch reaction, Hunt Showdown, yeah, that Twitch reaction can help, but ultimately it's your strategy and how you maneuver that will win your gunfights over who sees you first and who can pump the bullets in fastest.
that's one thing I really did enjoy with my time playing Hunt Showdown is it was there's a lot more tactics, a lot more thought and strategy involved in trying to survive or, you know, take down the creature or get to the extraction point. It's not just run in and, like you said, fan the trigger and hope that you land the bullets. Like, you need to go at things at a very calculated angle. And I enjoyed that it was a little bit more of a slower paced chess match as opposed to just going in, bam, 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 and, you know, either winning or losing. It was nice and very, very stressful and very dread inducing, like anxiety for me as well, because every little step you trigger a bird when you're walking through like a cornfield or through a swamp area, or you tread on something and it like a stick breaks. Like, it's some scary stuff, not only just from the monsters roaming around the traps, but also the other real players that are trying to gun you down at the same time. It's a great formula, and maybe now we're talking about it, I need to get back and spin a few rounds up because I had a good time with it.
Yeah, the game to me still has some of the best audio design in the industry,
because
that's how you really hunt most of our players, is by you hear them before you see them.
Yeah.
And yes, and along with like how you say the fear and anxiety as you progress, it's very much learning when to walk and when to run, when to move fast and when to move slow.
Yeah, it's perfected that Kenny Rogers methodology of, know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk away, know when to run. Like, it is a hell of a time. And when you're talking about sort of the reliance on audio, obviously, listeners, you can upgrade your audio game over at Audio Technica on the website, which is audio-technica.com. Check yourself a nice juicy pair of ATH M50X headphones in to hear every step and every tree break and every bird squawk to hunt down them baddies. But Paul, let's maybe shift focus from hunt and video games into the greatness that is anime. Like I mentioned in the intro there that some of the titles that you referenced as some personal favorites, they really resonate with me because they're on my favorites list as well. Like I talked about Lover's War, Full Metal Alchemist, and I love that you also highlighted Violet Evergarden, which I think is such a special series, is such a special franchise, and it not only has, you know, the traditional anime to check out, but there's some accompanying movies that they've released and a few little OVAs. But yeah, tell us about what your first experiences were with anime, how you got into this medium, things you love, things you hate, everything else in between. Let's talk some anime.
Getting into anime was mostly, I think, maybe a lot of us can express this. It's like when you first start off, you don't really realize that you're watching anime when you're a little kid. But I think one of the first I can really remember is catching my cousins watching Evangelion when I was really young.
As a young Paul, when you saw Neon Genesis Evangelion, could you understand quite what was going on? Because there is a lot happening in Evangelion.
No, absolutely not. I had no idea. And I was like so young. Like I can only just have vague memories of sort of like my cousins watching it. And I've just walked in like, what's this? And it's like, oh, don't worry about it. It's like, oh, okay.
Just go play over there. Don't worry. This is too much for you, little Paul.
But then growing up, I think my main memories for getting into anime sort of more hardcore is in high school with catching up with my best friends like Alex, which you probably know, Alex and Andrew.
Yes, I do. Good fellas. Very good fellas.
Yeah, like I think they got me into, well, Alex specifically, and then we dragged Andrew into it. Alex and I used to watch anime together. Like we'll go home after school, watch all, you know, the shonen and like Dragon Ball Z and Yu Yu Hakusho and Sailor Moon even. And then we would go to the video rental shop and rent like any anime we could really find there as well.
I love that. Like, I think you're the first person that has been on the show so far that has explored anime in that route where, you've gone to Video Easy or Civic Video or whatever the video store is, and even if they're still around today, which is a sad thing to think about, and hunted it down. Like, did your local video store have a good selection of anime that you could pick from, or were you sort of just left with, I guess, the main stalwarts, like you mentioned, Dragon Ball, and maybe you'd see like Akira and Ghost in the Shell, just the big, I guess, notable titles as opposed to some of the more specific, less known titles, I guess you could say, for mainstream media?
So from memory, I believe it was Video Easy we went to. So not a Blockbuster or anything. It was more of a smaller let's say, sort of brand of rental shop. And, like, let's just say one of the shows that I do remember picking up from their rental was Chobits.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So definitely not just, you know, generic, like, his shonens and stuff that's safe for kids. They had stuff that was definitely, like, a lot more range of genres.
Yeah, Chobits is certainly not aimed at children, that's for sure. It's it's a very unique viewing experience, I guess we could say.
And speaking of not aimed for children, we actually found in not the anime section, but in the cartoon kids section, a hentai.
Oh!
Yeah.
Just tucked in there beside, like, Blinky Bill and, you know, Oliver Twist or something.
And obviously we did check it out and whoof, that was definitely a hentai. I don't know what that was doing in that beer store.
God, I wonder if like the Video Easy staff member knew what it was and was having a bit of a chuckle, like, I'm going to get these kids, you wait. And they just plant Legend of the Overfiend or whatever it is hiding in there amongst the fox and the hound.
For some reason, Legend of the Overfiend sounds like that might have been it.
Yeah, you'd see like... I remember as a kid, like my mum used to work at a video store. I was in a very small country town, so we didn't get Video Easy until much later, but we had a place called Video 2000. And I'd try and hunt down good anime as well. And I'd always see in the R-rated or the adult or the mature anime titles, you'd always see Legend of the Overfiend, you'd always see Wicked City, you'd always see Ninja Scroll, and then some of those other big ones that you reference. But I remember watching Overfiend as well as Wicked City at a very young age. I'm like, whoa, what is happening here? What are they doing to these poor innocent women? Mom, should I be watching this? Because I was, I don't know, I would have been like 12 when I caught those two. I watched Ninja Scroll much younger than that too. So I was, my mind was getting blown regularly because I'm thinking this is just a cartoon, but it is anything, but it is very naughty and definitely not for kids. So yeah, any parents listening, don't let your kids watch Legend of the Overfiend because they'll have a lot of questions afterwards, I'm sure.
Indeed.
Yeah, so, Violet Evergarden, tell me about your feelings towards this because, I mentioned earlier, I love this anime. I love this character. I love this story. It's some of my favorite anime of all time, anything surrounding her and her story. Like, it's such a beautiful story and it's so beautifully animated. What's your takeaways on Violet Evergarden?
So I will apologize. It's been a couple of years since I watched it, so my memory is going to be very
faded,
you know, fuzzy about it. Mm-hmm. But what I remember is, you know, obviously the animation style and the art direction is very beautiful. So that's one thing that definitely caught my eye. And then I'm just a sucker for anyone that has robotic arms, like in like Full Metal Alchemist style.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely the first draw in. And then, you know, watching the show and it caught my interest of, if I remember correctly, it's a like sort of child soldier that grew up on the battlefield and then she ends up getting her arms sort of blown off, replaced with metallic arms. And then because of, I think the person she loved died, which at this point she doesn't know, she goes into like writing letters because in this universe, because of the war, lots of people never learned how to write.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You were bang on the money.
Yeah, so there's an organization designed to write letters, but not word for word. It's supposed to be more of an artistic sort of take to it. So she, throughout the series, needs to sort of learn how to sort of become, I guess, human in a sense, instead of being this cold sort of warrior, sort of logical killer, become more human and learn love and emotions. And jump into that specifically, the one that always sticks to me is episode 10. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you remember what that one is.
Off the top of my head, I can't. So maybe give me the rough beats on 10 because, I'm struggling to remember what 10. So, was that like, was 10 around the time where... Is it like with the young kid and is that the young kid with this? It's not a sick father. It's a sick mother.
Mother. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Yeah. That's the one. That is the one. It's pretty much so the mother, I don't think we know that she's sick to begin with. All we know is she comes in to write letters for her, like lots and lots of letters. Like they're spending a lot of time in the workroom and the kid is getting more attached to, Is her name Evelyn in the series? I have terrible names.
You mean the daughter in that episode?
The main character, sorry. It's like, I'm terrible names. I'm sure she's the namesake of the...
No, so the lead is Violet Evergarden. Yeah, so that's her name.
Yeah, sorry. Like I said, I'm terrible with names to begin with as well. Like, the anime we're going to talk about, I've got all of their names written down because I can't remember them. But yeah, like, the child, that like, the little kid is connected more with Violet because he's spending more time with her than the mother. But by the time the episode finishes, you realize... the mother's actually, that whole time, spent writing letters that will be delivered to her for the rest of her life on her birthday, every birthday until whenever she passes away, because we've learned the mother has an illness that she's going to die from soon.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Like that, the series as a whole, but I remember that episode especially, like, I cry a lot watching things, and Violet Evergarden was certainly no exception, because it, like you said, it's just beautiful storytelling. It's beautifully drawn and animated. The voice work, whether you're watching sub or dub, is phenomenal as well. And yeah, even though we can't relate to having robot arms and being a ghostwriter for a postal service in like a, you know, universe that we don't really exist in day to day here, you can really put yourselves in a lot of the character's shoes and understand how they'd feel in these moments, because it's, even though, yeah, she's missing her arms and she's a ghostwriter, and I think the auto memory doll is what they call these ghostwriters that write the letters on behalf of other people. The way they're conveying emotion and sharing these stories with their loved ones, because yeah, they don't know how to put pen to paper or letters to a piece of paper from a typewriter. They convey that on behalf of them as an auto memory doll, and it's just really touching. It's really heartfelt, and each one of the episodes is unique and tells its own story. Like each episode, like they can act as their own capsule where it's sort of siloed off storytelling, but it also weaves in the broader story of Violet and how she came to be. And oh man, I love it. So I'm so happy that you referenced it, because it's a special anime that I don't feel enough people talk about. Like, I don't know many people in my orbit that have talked about it or watched it. So I love that you've checked it out and it's one of your favorites. And you can remember some of these episodes so well, because it hits like a truck.
Yeah, well, that's why I like, whenever someone asks me a recommendation for anime, I always recommend that anime, because that, like, specifically that episode 10 has just stuck with me for so long.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Yeah. And it just goes to show, like, yeah, anime is so much more than just a cartoon. Like, it's a medium that you can tell so many different stories that can make you feel so many different emotions. And it's just a special, special thing that people need to check out more of and take more chances on, instead of going, oh, it's just a kid related thing. It's cartoons. Like, there's nothing here for an adult to take away. You're so wrong. And Violet Evergarden, I think, really, really encompasses the rightness that is anime, because yeah, it's so good. It's so good. And like you mentioned, Love is War, fantastic. Obviously, Fullmetal Alchemist Brotherhood, or Fullmetal Alchemist, depending on which way you lean, is some of the best anime of all time as well. So you've got some good taste, and it was a little daunting me trying to find an anime for you to check out next. So listeners, if this is your first time stopping on by More Than Hentai, the way it works is I'll have the co-host fill out a bit of a Q&A that I put together just to get an understanding of who they are, what they like to watch, what they have and haven't watched, maybe certain things or certain genres that they enjoy. And based off that Q&A, I'll go and have a think and then try and recommend anime for them. We then check out the first episode of said anime. We go spoilers front to back on the first episode only. We don't go through and ruin any major plot points, twists and turns throughout the entire anime series itself. So we're going to deep dive on the episode, the first episode in question today, but we aren't going to sort of, spoil anything outside of that. So yeah, nothing's off limits for episode one that we're going to be checking out. But the anime, or the title in focus for this episode that I've put forward to Paul, is something called Toradora. And it's a Japanese romantic comedy / light novel series by Yukio Takamiya with illustrations by Yasu. The series includes 10 novels released between March 10th, 2006 and March 10th of 2009. A manga adaptation ran from 2007 through to 2008 in Denkeki Comic Gao. 2009 also saw the release of an additional light novel spin-off, as well as a playable visual novel game on the PlayStation Portable. A 25-episode anime adaptation produced by JC Staff, aired between October 2008 and March of 2009. And Toradora currently holds a score of 8.07 on My Anime List, which is based off 1.3 million user scores and is rated as the 23rd most popular anime on the site overall. And the story of Toradora is as follows. Ryuji Takatsu is a gentle high school student with a love for housework. But in contrast to his kind nature, he's an intimidating face that often gets him labeled as a delinquent. On the other hand, Taiga Aisaka, a small doll-like student who is anything but a cute and fragile girl, equipped with a wooden katana and a feisty personality. Taiga is also known through the school as the Palm Top Tiger. One day, an embarrassing mistake causes the two students to cross paths and hijinks ensue. Toradora is a romantic comedy that follows this odd duo as they embark on a quest to help each other with their respective crushes, forming an unlikely alliance in the process. So we are going to be tackling episode one, which is known as Tiger and Dragon. Paul, where do you want to start off on Toradora?
I guess, like, just quickly, I'd like to say, is like, I'm glad this is a nice short series because it's nice to be able to just finish something. Because a lot of animes have a problem of never finishing.
Yeah,
if you know what
true.
I mean.
Very true. Like, if we talk about One Piece that's creeping towards 1,100 episodes, for example, and your Dragon Ball Z's and things that just go forever and will never die, where this is a nice, closed-off, complete story told across 25 episodes, you get a really great beginning, really great middle, and a really great end, in my opinion, but we won't talk about that. But yeah, episode one, Tiger and the Dragon, we get a cold open, and we meet Reiji and Tiger delivering their own sort of like little inner monologues, talking about, like, they're not really referencing it directly, but you can assume they're sort of indirectly talking about love and life and just accepting that, you know, whatever happens in life and whatever plays out for you as a person is that's the way it's meant to be. So it's kind of cool that we're getting introduced to these two characters and they're seeing their respective worlds where we're seeing Ryuji in his sort of small, humbling flat, which is a little bit messy. And then we see Tiger in this sort of larger apartment. So we can sort of see the immediate contrast between the two characters, but they're alluding to straight away that they're sort of sharing similar values. And then it jumps straight into the open, which is a song called Pre-Parade by Rei Kagemiya. It's a bit of a J-pop banger. So it really sets the tone. Like, we get a pretty subdued cold open and then straight into the open, which is just this real funky toe tapper. So how did you find these opening scenes?
Yeah, no, so to begin with, like, the cold open with the two characters, as you said, like, all that stuff that you said was true, but along with, like, showing their personalities with Ryuji is a clean freak. You say, like, his apartment is messy, but, in like, specifically in that episode, he finds a piece of mold and he has to dive straight into it. So it's like an obsessive cleaning disorder. Really, it has to be clean. And I believe it shows with his mother, even in the first scene, how she's dependent on him. So you can see straight away that the adult in this situation seems to be the child, and the child has to be the adult, where you've got the opposite with Taiga, with her messy apartment, and it's extremely messy. And she's still, I think, if I remember correctly, laying around in her scene.
Yeah, she's a bit more sloth-like in comparison. To Ryuji, who, like you said, like, so we see that open and he's sort of cleaning around the kitchen area and he notices a bit of mold and is mortified. We get the opening with a bit of a banger of a track. They introduce us to the main cast of characters in the open as well, where we sort of get a couple of highlights of Ryuji and Tiger, but they also introduce us to three other friends of both respective characters in that as well. The open as well, it's quick to sort of set the tone that, yeah, Tiger, she's a feisty little, like, she's a little firecracker of a human being. Like, she's running around. She's a little bit of a wild thing. She's got a wooden katana that she sort of carries around with herself. Like, she's this little ball of energy. So you can sort of understand how she'll be as a person pretty quickly. The opening ends, and, yeah, we see Ryuji cleaning the house, like you mentioned. Like, he can't stand any mess, any disorder. So he is making the flat spotless. We then are introduced to his mother, who is passed out in the cupboard or in his doorway.
A small extra room. Yeah. I'm not quite sure of the house layout.
So she's passed out. She's not wearing a whole lot. So we can kind of see, like you mentioned, that in this situation, the roles are reversed, where Ryuji is, I guess, playing more so the role of the parent as opposed to his mother, Yasuko. So yeah, she's a bit more free spirited. And we find out a bit later in the episode that she goes out, she works late, she parties a lot. She's a bit of a menace as well, but yeah, Ryuji, he's just, you know, very, even though he doesn't look it, he's very caring, he's very kind, and he likes order. He likes to have a house that he can be proud of. So yeah, he cleans up the place. The mum's awoken, and then he's going to school. But the mum then triggers Ryuji, where once she sort of wakes up, she says a line where she goes, "Ryuji, you've got that evil glint in your eyes. Every day you're looking more and more like your daddy." And that triggers him in a very negative way. It really upsets him. So you can start to see and think, okay, what's happened? Like, has the dad, you know, left? Has he abandoned this family? Is he not a good guy? Why does Ryuji feel so strongly about his dad and getting compared to him? And then you see also that his mum is a bit of a mess as well. So he's I guess you could say he's probably had a pretty tough upbringing, and you sort of really understand that in the first sort of 5 minutes of the episode.
Yeah. Sorry, like all my brain is jumping to is like things are like a little bit details are shown a little bit later about the father.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can jump there now if you want. Like, it flows onto the story.
I'm just saying, it's like, as we're talking about the father, like, we do get a glimpse for this, only this episode, for now, you do get a glimpse of a photo of him to see, it's like, and I think you see, it's like, it's probably a little bit of a, like, like he was delinquent or maybe mafia. It's like, you're not entirely sure, sort of. But you get the feelings like, I wasn't too sure at this point if he was dead or if he was abandonment. So, but all that's important at this point in time is his mother solely raised him. And at this point of his life, he's pretty much now looking after everything as she does late night shifts.
Yeah, correct. So yeah, sort of jumping forward, we'll just sort of put a bow on the father discussion. We find out later, about sort of 2/3 of the way through the episode, that dad's a bit of a hooligan. It's a bit of a menace, and yeah, the mum always had sort of heart eyes for the father. Thought he was a bit of a hunk, but also that she liked that he was a bit of a bad guy. And there's a line where she goes, "Your father, even, you know, back in the day, he used to put magazines under his shirt in case people tried to stab him." So you're like, okay, yeah, maybe he is some type of underworld sort of figure here, where he was doing some bad stuff, and yeah, maybe he was part of the Yakuza or something. Who knows? That doesn't get directly referenced there, but you realize that one, that his father has passed away, and two, yeah, his father was in some pretty heavy stuff growing up, but the mum just sort of looked past all that and just loved him for what he was, which was a bit of a sweetheart-hearted menace. But it's tough for Ryuji because he's really struggling with that connection and the fact that he's inherited the looks from his father. And we see that sort of follow on pretty quickly there. So he leaves home in a bit of a huff because, yeah, mum's saying she's got that evil glint in his eyes. And we find out pretty quickly that not only mum sees that, but the rest of society sees that as well, because he's walking to school on the way to school, and a couple of kids bump into him accidentally. And just with his natural look, he's got like this very evil glare in his eyes, like that mum mentioned earlier. And everybody sees it. Everyone's terrified of the guy, and they even give him their wallets in fear because they don't want to get hurt. And then there's people in the crowd saying, "Oh, he gives off really bad psycho vibes." Like, you feel for this kid. He's just trying to live a life, and everyone just feels that he's just this evil, sinister menace.
Yeah, so it's like what's to say? It's like the male equivalent. It could be even still same even for males. The resting sort of bitch face.
Mm.
It's the resting. I don't know.
Supervillain face or something.
Supervillain face. He's just got the glare that's always sort of on. And I believe during this war, it sort of explains that they've just finished, I believe, how's it go, middle school in Japan.
Yep.
And he's moving up to the senior part of, like, he's learning now. I think the last 3 years. Anyway, so this is to him is like, oh, this is going to be a fresh start. It's like, I'm not going to be, it's like, I want to break this delinquent sort of persona that's around me. And this goes back to like the opening where he was trying to mess with his hair and looking at a magazine to try and make himself look less scary.
Yeah, yeah. And sadly, that was not the case because, yeah, he takes 10 steps, bumps into two kids, they shit their pants, give him their wallets out of fear of getting beaten up, and they run away. And yeah, Ryuji's like, oh, well, yeah, clearly it's not going to be a new day. Like, yeah, the delinquent Monica has followed him into high school. And yeah, it's tough because everywhere he goes, people, you can see them in the background or in the foreground. They're whispering amongst themselves. Everyone's always looking at him out of fear and just feeling very uncomfortable. Everyone's terrified of Ryuji. And so that would be a heavy burden to bear. But luckily, as he gets to school, you can still see as he's walking down the hallways, yeah, people at school are terrified of him. You find out later the teachers are terrified of him. But then
that's a funny scene. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great scene. We'll talk about that soon too. But then we meet Kitamura, who is Ryuji's friend, who is not terrified of him. He just sees he's a good guy and they're buds and they're getting along well. And it's nice to see. It's like, great, you've got someone in your life that backs you and supports you and is not in fear of their life anytime they're near you.
And that's very, very much Kitamura's, like, what you get his vibe straight away is smart and calm. Like, that's sort of the vibe you get straight from his character just by his design and how his first interactions are.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's nice to sort of see that tension get broken a little bit where you're like, man, is this guy just going to be talked about and be the isolated loner throughout this episode or throughout this anime? But no, it shows, all right, he's got at least someone in his corner. He's got someone that backs him, that sees the good in Ryuji. But yeah, as they're walking the hall together, heading towards class, you can still see everyone else in the hallway. They're whispering, they're staring. You can hear some of the commentary where, yeah, he's perceived as a dirtbag and he's a delinquent and he's a villain and all these things, which is really sad. But then we get introduced to another character.
Oh, our second sort of protagonist that we've already talked about, Tiger, comes down the hallway. And even more talks in hushed whispers of this other delinquent when the two end up bumping into each other. Now, was this after? Actually, no. Did I skip ahead?
You did. So we meet Minori. Yeah, we meet Minori.
Yeah, we meet Minori first. I apologize.
That's all right.
Yeah, no. We meet Minori first. My apologies. A high energy, optimistic girl that our main character Ryuji, as we can see, has a bit of a crush on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very sweet because, you see from the outside, everyone just perceives Ryuji as this hardened guy that's just going to kick everybody's ass if you look at them the wrong way. But then you see the second Minori comes up, who is primarily, she's Kitamura's friend first and foremost. But then we see, that Ryuji's got a bit of a crush because he remembers her first and her last name. And she's like, oh, you know my full name? Like, that's so sweet. Like, she's, like you said, impressed. Perfectly. Like, she's very optimistic. Yeah. She's very kind. She's very sweet. And you see quickly afterwards, once she is impressed that he remembers the full name, she runs off in a puff of smoke. And you can see she's very high energy, like you said. Like, she seems like she's going to be a fun character throughout this adventure.
Yeah. And then rewind back to where I was talking before of Tiger appearing. This is where Tiger actually appears because Ryuji and Tiger accidentally bump into each other. And there's a bit of a joke of her being short here, where it's like, who just bumped into me?
Yeah.
As he looks around, it's like, oh. And this is where we see we start to see that personality of Tiger is very blunt and straightforward, where she knocks him out.
Yeah, it's such a great first direct meeting with these two, where, Ryuji's just, I guess, off in his own little world after seeing Minori and thinking about his little high school crush there, turns around, starts walking down the hallway, bumps into Tiger, who is, this tiny little thing. Straight away, you can hear the kids in the hallway and the other students straight away. They're like, oh, my God, the two heavy hitters of the high school, they're coming together on day one? Like, what's going to happen? Like, oh, my God, it's rah-rah-rah. It's big drama. It's big fights. And, we hear the reference to Tiger being known as the Palm Top Tiger. And that is because, she's a small, little, tiny, tiny human, but is violent and wild and will hurt you like a tiger. So I love that nickname. I think it perfectly embodies Tiger as a person. And Ryuji quickly puts two and two together as far as what that nickname means. And he says sort of in his inner thoughts in these moments where he's like, she's like a doll, but she's intense and it looks like she'll chew you up. And like you said, straight away, after they have this little brief exchange, she just goes the big old uppercut straight to the jaw and knocks out Ryuji in one hit. It's so good. It's such a good scene.
Yeah. Yeah, early on, like, that's very much her personality. It's very action first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I respect that. I respect that. Yeah, she never takes a backward step, but I want to say, like, this next part was a little jarring for me, how it sort of, like, it flashes forward then to they're in class, but there's been no reference, like, you know, you assume, like, Ryuji, it looked like he got knocked out cold, so you think he would have went to the nurse's office or something, or there'd be some type of big grand drama and spectacle that followed on from that, but it was just like, boom, knocked out, now we're in class learning about maths. Like, it was a bit of a weird cut.
Like, from that, the most you really get is them, like, the kids are whispering in the back, and they sort of mention, and it's like, saying stuff like, oh, maybe Ryuji isn't a delinquent as much as we thought, because even Kitamura says, well, at least it's not all bad. Look over there, and they reference where it's like, yeah, so the outlook, her punching him out pretty much made it so it's like, oh, he's not, maybe not as bad as we thought.
Yeah, that was a good moment, and yeah, I love that you caught that too, because yeah, Kitamura highlights it pretty quickly. He's like, hey, look, like, you know, things are changing at school. Like, people aren't thinking that you're just this human hurt machine. Like, you're a real person that maybe people can get to know and be friends with. And contrasting that, we also see, like, Tiger fully out of her violent uppercut mindset as well, where she's sitting at her desk, and we find out that her and Minori are friends. And poor little Tiger, she's suffering from sinus issues. She's got some allergies. We find out that she's dealing with a lot of dust in the house or the place she's living in, and it's made her sinuses all messed up. And then for such a tiny, meek little creature, she drops the most loud, aggressive, snot-laden sneeze in an anime that I think I've seen. I'm like, whoa, that's big time. But it also just embodies, you know, the energy and the power that this little body has in it.
Yeah. And then also from this small little moment, we catch the glimpse of her getting a glimpse of someone that she might be, you know, having some liking towards.
Mm-hmm. I do like that it was really subtle. It was really quick scene in the way they framed it. Like, I didn't pick up on it the very first time I watched Toradora, to be honest, but sort of doing a few rewatches for this podcast, and also I just did a seasonal rewatch of it earlier this year, I picked up on that little tell, and it's like, oh, interesting. Does young Tiger here have a bit of a crush on Kitamura? What is going on? But it really sort of left us hanging in that moment, because then we flash forward to Ryuji meeting with the school counselor, who's telling him very scaredly, I must say, that, you know, you need to put in your future plans. You need to sort of fill out this documentation about, you know, what your career looks like. Like, what do you want to do in the future? And he's standing there, like, he's just so relaxed. Like, he's a big unit, naturally imposing, but, like, he's so aloof to that with his teacher. But she's terrified. She feels like he's going to attack her as well, which was hilarious.
No, it was funny seeing her squirm in her seat as he just sort of casually standing there. And it's like, oh, sorry, I haven't decided what I want to do with my life.
And then he's like, but I'll do it. And she's like, no, it's okay, don't worry. I'm sorry to be stressing you out and whatever. Like, it was really funny to see even the teachers are a little bit fearful. Like, even the adults are worried that Ryuji is going to cause some ruckus. So after this exchange with the school counselor, which has ran later than he hoped it has, and he's rushing back to class to grab his things, because you can see, again, that sort of parental vibe that he has, where he's like, oh man, I don't think I'm going to get to the shops in time to get the discounted groceries for tonight for dinner. So you can already see that he's taking on the sort of head of the household again there. Rushes back to class, opens the door of the classroom, and it looks like a hurricane has gone through. Desks and chairs are everywhere. And then there's this weird, funny, hilarious moment where he's not quite sure what's happened, and there's one singular locker standing up against the wall, and the locker falls down, and Tiger rolls out of the locker almost like a really stiff, wooden, rigid hand grenade. And you're just like, what has happened here? How has the room gotten to this state? Why is she in the locker? Please explain.
It's really funny that you call her a hand grenade, because that really is what she is at that moment.
Yeah.
It's funny, on my second viewing, when I was watching it today just as a refresh, because I didn't quite understand what happened that scene to begin with. Like, because it's just, you go in there and all the things just went flying. And on my rewatch, I realized everything goes flying because in that instant, she's ran from wherever she was into that locker and hit so hard that it's come back down and landed on the floor and made her roll out.
Totally agree with you on the observation. Yeah, she panicked because she's clearly in hysterics in this room to find something. Here's someone coming to the classroom from down the hallway, freaks out, and just the momentum of this tiny little hand grenade of a human being has just sent the room into disarray and then, yeah, knocked the locker over. It's a really great moment, and it cracked me up. And then they realize in this situation again, because, yeah, the first interaction they had earlier in the day is where she knocked him out. He's trying to grab his school bag. They realize they've got the same bag. So there's some confusion there. I wasn't quite sure what was happening as far as why she's so resistant to allow Ryuji to grab his school bag. They start this tug of war and it's a back and forth David and Goliath type of situation going on here. She eventually sort of releases the bag. He falls over. He's confused what's happening. She gets upset and leaves and calls him a dumbass as she walks out the door. But then also you see the sweetness straight after this again. Ryuji gets up, still in a bit of a confused state as far as what's happening, looks around the classroom, sees that, yes, it is in disarray, and he stays and cleans up and puts it all back to normal. Like, he's just a nice guy. Like, he's an evil-looking dude with a big old sweetheart.
It makes me wonder, it's like, is it really nice that he's obsessing? Because it's just like, OCD is like, I cannot leave this room the way it is. I have to clean it.
Yeah, that's a very astute observation, actually. Yeah, I didn't sort of think of it to that level where it's borderline obsessive. So I think you're onto something there, Paul. So yeah, cleans up the classroom, then it flashes forward. We see that it's late, but he's doing some study for school and he's filling out his documentation for the counselor. And that's where we get that little recap about his dad that we talked about earlier in the episode and where he was hiding magazines in case people tried to stab him. I wanted to shout out to mini disc players. I think this is the first anime I've ever seen where someone's using the old mini disc audio player to listen to their tunes. I thought that was a great little reference and a really deep cut for me because I had a mini disc player for a hot minute for some dumb reason in the 2000s, but I had a little bit of a fist bump moment with Ryuji that we're mini disc brothers.
Like, that didn't even register to me. It's like, mini disc player, is that like the same disc technology that the PSP saw used?
Yeah,
okay. So it's like it's a disc that's inside a sort of casing, right?
Correct, yeah. And it's pretty much like, and that's how you'd first store your MP3s. You could do, I think on them you could maybe store up to, say, 50 songs on a mini disc. So it was a cool way to have like a lot of tunes on there before that iPod revolution really started to kick off. So, yeah, I loved my mini disc player. I felt great to be able to have all these songs on these little discs as opposed to like a CD that might only hold, you know, 20 tracks. I could hold 50 on a mini disc. I was like, hell yeah. Ryuji's my boy. He's got one as well.
Yeah. Now I went from CD players, which I remember walking to school and I had like cheap ones. So it's always skipping as it's bouncing in my, in my bag. And then after school, getting into the digital age with I didn't have iPad. I had like a Zune, I think, or something like that.
That's right, a Zune. I was trying to think when I mentioned iPod before. I'm like, what was the other thing that was around? It was a Zune. God damn, that's a word I haven't thought of or a brand I haven't thought of in years.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah.
But yeah, we don't get any Zune references here. But yeah, we have this moment. And then as he's trying to do his career plan, he jumps into his school bag to find that documentation to fill that out for the counselor. But then he stumbles across a little love letter in his bag there that Tiger had, and it was addressed to Mr. Yasuka Katamura, who is obviously Ryuji's best buddy. He doesn't want to open the letter because he's a good guy, but somehow, just I guess due to his giant man hands and just fumbling aloofness that he has sometimes, the letter accidentally opens. He panics. He re-steals it very dodgily, but then he realizes too, no letter. Envelope anyway.
Now, I just rewatched this and I don't think it's he opens it. He actually brings it up to the light and then he gets to see through, he sees through the letter
because of the light. Yeah, okay.
So he opens it.
I thought he did because, like, you can see when he's looking up at the light as he sealed it, it looks like the back is sort of a bit dodgy, like the little heart, like sticker or stamp that's sealing the letter on the point. It looks like it's been moved. So maybe you're right.
Honestly, that was my first reaction too. And it was only just when I was watching it just today, I was like, no, that looks more like he's looking at the light and the light's shining through it and he could see through the paper.
I think you're right. I like that. Let's go with that. I think you bang on there. So yeah, it's funny. And he has a bit of a chuckle to himself when he realizes that, Tiger has in air quotes written this love letter, but the love letter is not in the envelope. So the love letter is somewhere out there. Who knows where?
Yeah. And with this interaction, we sort of see another sort of trait of Tiger that she's actually a bit of a klutz. Like with the putting the letter in the wrong bag, not putting the letter in the envelope, and then how like she ran into the locker and fell out. It's like she's a bit of a klutz.
Yeah. She's a little tiny ball of chaos, which I love. And that's where we get to the official midpoint of the episode. We get a little transitional scene. And it's really late in the evening, and Ryuji is woken up by noises in the apartment. At first, he's like, "Oh, it won't be mum because she's still at work." And we flash quickly to a scene where we find out that his mum is a very popular entertainer slash hostess at a bar or like a nightclub type scenario where she's partying with various people and drinking a lot. So we can see the world that the mum lives in, very free spirited, very fast and loose. And so he gets up. And he starts walking through the apartment and he notices the window is open to the apartment. And from the shadows, we see Tiger appear with her wooden katana and then a struggle and a fight breaks out between the two.
Oh, yeah, no. A fun scene of being back and forth between the two with, I don't think much is said until the lights are turned on and it's revealed it is Tiger. Where at this point, her still suffering from her little sniffles, wipes her boogers on a piece of clothing that's nearby as her Ryuji. What the hell? Don't just wipe your wherever you want.
I love that part. Yeah. So it really escalates this scene where I'm like, oh, wow, we've got like this intruder scenario happening. Yeah. Ryuji's not sure who's trying to rob him, attack him, kill him. The fact that, yeah, she's got this wooden katana and she's using it pretty expertly. Like it's a cool little brief fight scene. Yeah, he flicks the light on. We see that she's still suffering from her sinus issues and yeah, wipes all the goobers all over his school shirt, I think. It's like a plain white shirt. Yeah, Ryuji obviously gets upset about that. And then she goes back to attack mode and continues the fight going on, ends up sort of puncturing the wall in Ryuji's apartment. But then they're sort of having a bit of back and forth now because they know who each other are, obviously, and they can see what the lights are on. He's trying to understand what the hell's happening, but then she tells him to forget about it because she realizes or assumes that he's read the love letter, and that's why she's broken in to try and take it back and, I guess, seek vengeance here.
I have to kill you so you can't talk.
Yeah, I love that because she goes, I can't live another second, but I don't want to die, so I'd rather kill you than kill myself. So she's there to try and kill him. But then sort of scales back the thought of killing into just like, you know what? Maybe I can just erase your memories by giving you a very fierce concussion. So she's trying to like clock him on the head with her wooden katana and the fight's happening. And yeah, we get that confirmation that she's freaking out about the love letter while she's still trying to deliver this final kill shot or this concussion shot. And that's where Ryuji yells out, hey, you don't have to worry. The envelope is empty. I haven't read the letter. It's just an envelope. All is good. And she sort of falls to the ground in defeat slash, I guess, acceptance and relief. And then you hear a little stomach grumble as well.
Yeah, I think it's a mix between, what, one, she's a bit sick, two, she's exhausted, and three, like, yeah, as you just said, hungry because of her sort of lifestyle, which we'll talk a little bit later in another scene coming up.
Yeah, so it's a cool little exchange. I love that we get a little bit of action. We get to see more of that feistiness that is Tiger. And then her realizing in that moment, it's like, oh, the letter's not there. Okay, maybe I don't have to kill this man or concuss this man. It's all good. But then you see those parental instincts immediately kick in with Ryuji when we hear the stomach growling. He goes and then cooks a big old feast at like 4 a.m. You know, like this guy's just a saint. I love him. And yeah, he cooks this giant feast and the little human hurricane that is Tiger is just like hoovering it down. She's got rice all over her face. And it's just a cute little moment where you see the contrast between the two, where, like we said at the start, like he's clean, he's controlled, he's organized. He's very sort of straighty 180, where she's just this little wild woman.
Yeah, like he's very much like, as he's had to grow up being the parent. And I think that's like the reason why he like feeds us assailant. It's like, oh, she's hungry and sick. It's like the instinct kicks in. It's like, I have to feed her. So I can't let this person starve in front of me. And that's what's like, where, with how far she eats, like you get that sort of like, does she not eat well at home? Like what's sort of going on there with her life that she's not eating enough to sustain herself?
I thought that exact same thing at this moment in the episode where, yeah, we've been introduced to both of Ryuji's parents, but we haven't met either of Tiger's parents. So it's like, what's happening here? Is this lack of a reveal or showcasing of the parents? Is that sort of, is the silence just telling us everything we need to know there, where the silence means, or the lack of scene time means that they're just not around, they don't care about her, what's happening? And yeah, everything up until this moment certainly implies that in my head when I was watching.
It's funny, like really thinking about it, they're both opposites, but they're also similar in lots of ways as well. Because like, once we're going to get there, but they both have parent issues in some way, and they're both seen as delinquents at school, one more deserved than the other. But it's just interesting where they're similar in some ways, but also complete opposites in others.
Mm. Yeah, no, I agree 100%.
So it's very interesting. It's not just one way or the other. So I think that's what you get with some other shows, where it's just like, are they complete opposites and opposite tracks, or, oh, they're completely made for each other. You know, but this one is like, no, they've got their good sides, bad sides, and like there are points where like they're both very different, but also very same at the same time.
Yeah, this is the moment or a part of this episode where, like, when I was writing my notes, as far as Tiger, I sort of wrote down exactly what you said there, but I also expanded on. I'm like, I like that she's this sort of, she's a very contrasting or juxtaposed character where she's really proud, she's headstrong and determined, but also in this moment where you see her eating and he highlights all the, like he gives her a tissue to clean her face off, she gets really shy and timid and a little nervous and embarrassed. So I like that, yeah, what you said perfectly describes both of them. Like they're flawed characters, they're real characters. They're not, like, they've got rough edges, they're not perfect, they're not prim and proper. They're great in their own ways and they're different in their own ways, but then they're similar in a lot of ways that we see over these 25 episodes. So I thought it was really, really cute, this exchange at the dinner table at, yeah, some ungodly hour. And then, yeah, Ryuji sort of steps up again and he's like, you know, don't be embarrassed about the love letter. Don't worry about it. You've got nothing to be ashamed about. And speaking of shame, he then goes, just wait a minute, runs off to his room, and he comes back with, like, I'm just going to call his box of shame or his box of love. And he rips the lid off it and he goes into detail to Tiger about all these love letters and all these notes he writes about his crush, the playlist that he's prepared for his crush with, like, his favorite musical songs that will imply his feelings to this girl, general love notes, fantasies, plans for the future. Like, he hasn't planned out his career with the council at all, but he certainly planned out his life with his crush. And this is where we get the official confirmation that he's crushing on Minori.
Yeah.
Who we seen all earlier, because she's reading through his notebook and it was like, you know, to Minori. And she was like, whoa. And then we as the viewer get that confirmation as well that, yeah, Ryuji's crushing on a girl we met a few minutes ago.
Now, that's interesting. You said something that I never actually really, for some reason, connected, that he has his whole life sort of love life planned ahead, but he doesn't have his future planned. And I never connected those two for some reason. I don't know why. I guess because the work, like, future thing was, like, sort of just said at the start. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. And then it was really cool when she finds that he likes Minori, and just, like, she's way out of your league.
Just stomps him straight into the ground, doesn't she? Like,
but that's very much, I think, a best friend sort of thing. It's like protecting. It's like, no, you stay away from my friend.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, like you can see, even though, yeah, she's a pocket-sized little thing, you know, she's the little tiger. But you can see how much she cares straight away as far as Minori and yeah, no one's ever going to be good enough. It was sort of quickly is the feeling I got from this part where, yeah, the old palm top tiger is keeping Minori safe. But I do like that she's blunt. Like she never minces her words. You know exactly what she's feeling and thinking for better or for worse in every scene in this first episode. And then like after this funny and cute and endearing embarrassing moment, we get this scene where we get introduced to Ryuji's pet bird, Inko. And I don't know what's going on with this bird. Like it feels like it's close to death for me or it's broken severely because Ryuji's like, come on, say your name. You can do it. You can do it. And this bird is like,
it looks like it's choking
on its words and it's struggling and it doesn't say its name. Instead, it almost just passes out from stress. And Tiger is very repulsed by this bird and this situation. And then she just punches him again for whatever reason. It's just like, okay, fair enough. That's just how you show your emotions.
I never was sure what's up with the bird. It's like, I don't know. I don't know if it lands for me, but it's there.
Yeah, it felt a little forced. Like, and we do get a little bit more bird play in future episodes. Like, it's not just a throwaway scene here. Inko plays a part, and it's a very valued member of Ryuji's family. But yeah, so Tiger, whack, gets Ryuji again. And then he's saying, you've got to go. My mom's going to be home soon, because he realizes it's like 5 a.m. or so in the morning. They've got to go to school in a few hours. But yeah, you got to leave. Mom's coming. But Tiger's like, no, I can't leave because I don't trust you. You know too much as far as you know that I'm crushing on Kitamura. You know about the letter. You know about da 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 da. And then in this same sort of back and forth, she asks for advice. She's like, hey, can you give me some advice on love letters and on romance? Because clearly you've got an idea with his box of shame that he wheeled out before. And then we get this moment where she's like, you know what? Because he's like, yeah, I'll give you advice. You just got to go. We'll talk about it tomorrow. It's all fine. Don't worry. And then as she's leaving, she goes, obey me like a dog. I'll give an order and you must follow it. And yet Ryuji's like, yep, whatever you say, that's all fine. I'll be your dog. I'll obey you, whatever you say, you just got to go. And I'm like, sort of see the shift in power and the dynamic potentially start to build off that line where, yeah, she's the, I guess, a dog on to obey her every command and her every want and need.
Yeah, like if I remember correctly, I think it more went was like she asked for advice for the love letter because, as you said, he obviously writes a lot of poems and stuff, and she got this like, I want advice on that. And then in his rush to get around, it's like, all right, I'll give you any advice you want. And I think that's when she goes, oh, in that case, it's like a baby, like a dog, and it's like, and then
that's
yeah.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's like, I'll do anything. And she's like, oh, anything. And yeah, then
it's more or less he put the idea in her head because he was trying to rush her out. And it's like, oh, really?
Yeah, and then in this moment when he's trying to rush her out because, yeah, the panic's setting in that mum's coming home and he doesn't want to deal with that sort of stress and potential situation, she doesn't leave through the window. She's walking through the front door, and that's where we find out she's like, because Ryuji, again, nice gentleman, nice, respectable young man, I'll walk you home. It's fine. I'll walk home. She's like, no, it's fine. I live close by. And so it's like, okay, no worries. And then as she's leaving, Tiger gives Ryuji the love letter envelope and says, you know, use this to patch the hole from my blade attack earlier. You know, just plug the hole. It's fine. But if you do want to replace the panel, I'll pay for it. So it's nice that she remembered the damage she caused. She's thinking about the actions and the consequences of said actions. And then as she's leaving, she calls him by his first name, which he was like, oh, that's also a choice. That's interesting. And that's the end of that scene.
Yeah, yeah. Not much else to really add to that. Like moving on to the next day now, the morning, I think it goes straight into her calling.
Yeah, so he's already up. He's got the apron on and he's cooking breakfast getting ready for his day.
And he's cooking and she calls and I think he ignores her at first. And then calls again and he picks up that time and she gets a bit arse. Not happy with getting hung up on.
Yeah, so she calls. It's interesting because, yeah, we didn't see them exchange numbers and whatever else, so I'm not sure how they've got each other's details, but that's fine. We don't need to get too caught up in that. Yeah, she calls the first time and you can't really hear the words on the call, but you can hear it's like loud, intense noise. And he immediately just hangs up on it and then calls again. And she's like, how dare you? How dare you hang up on me? And she tells him to walk out to the balcony of the apartment. And he walks out of the balcony. And I cracked up with this scene because he walks straight outside of the balcony. And there's Tiger looking at him from the window directly opposite the balcony, like 2 meters away from each other. So like, oh, shit. So, okay, so that's how she got in the window, because they're literally neighbors that live 2 meters to 3 meters away from each other at any given moment.
Yeah, so I don't think we've actually mentioned this, but Ryuji lives in a sort of typical normal sort of Japanese house, but Tiger lives in a multi-story apartment building that's been built right next to his house.
Yeah, yeah, and it does gets referenced very briefly at the start, where when we mentioned that Yasuko, Ryuji's mother, when she wakes up and she's like, it's still so dark, can you open the blinds? And he sort of says, there's no, because the building next door, the giant big apartment complex, blocks all the sun out. And so it goes full circle here, and you're like, oh, so Tiger's living in this complex that's taking all the sunshine away from Ryuji and his mum.
So maybe it's supposed to be a metaphor of some sort. I'm not sure.
That's what I thought too. I thought, I wrote that down. I'm like, is this foreshadowing for later? Who knows? But so they have this exchange over the balcony. You can hear a little stomach grumble again. So Ryuji's like, hey, I'm going to make some breakfast. And because she's like, come on. So he makes some breakfast. And then he goes around to the apartment, enters the apartment. And like you mentioned earlier, that OCD / obsession about cleanliness dials up to 1,000, because the second he opens the door, he goes, it smells like ass in here. And he walks in and he's just horrified, because there's mess and filth and mold and like rotten stuff everywhere. And it triggers him big time.
Like something blurred out in the sink.
Yeah. I love a good blurred scene in an anime.
It's like you have to use imagination. Like, what's so bad that they had to blur it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But no, he goes absolutely mental, running around trying to find Tiger. It's like, what the hell? It's like, you need to clean this house. It's like, what? And then eventually he gets into a room and finds that she's, once again, into her character, sort of her character trait, she's going back to sleep.
Yeah.
Her little lady self. But I think it's like this point, he's like, it's the typical, I think, sort of trope of catching the girls asleep and seeing how cute they are when they're sort of asleep. Like, defenseless and adorable. And I think at this point, he just sort of like sighs and goes, all right, I'll give myself 15 minutes and I'll clean and cook and do everything.
Yeah, it's a nice moment. And yeah, when he finally finds her asleep in this giant room in an even bigger bed, it really just emphasizes how little she is. And he has this moment in his thoughts where he's like, she's really looking doll-like. And then there's this sad follow-on from that where he's like, and this apartment is empty like a dollhouse, because you see, she's living in this giant, giant, like, penthouse-like apartment, but there's minimal furniture there. There's no real life and, like, energy in the place. It's just full of dust, full of mess. It's really sad. And like you said, then he goes, you know what? I got 15 minutes, rolls up his sleeves, and gets to work cleaning and cooking.
Yeah. And once again, it just goes along with more characterization for Tiger. It's like, no parents. In his big apartment, that's obviously way too big for her. It sort of sets up like the mystery of what's going on with her character. Why is she in this situation?
Yeah, it left me with a few questions, because it was sad, because you think, and this is something like, I don't know too much about, like, if this is common in Japanese culture where a lot of these kids and young adults live by themselves for school. But like, that's a sad thought to me. Like, you know, you want to be growing up around family. Like, family is such a key part of your life. And to see these kids thrown into adulthood early in scenarios like this, it's really heartbreaking. So yeah, I was a little sad and a little worried for Tiger. And then we see her sort of stir from her little sleeping beauty moment. She walks out into the kitchen or the main living area in a little bit of a haze, and she looks around, and the apartment is now spotless. There's an amazing breakfast already cooked up and on the table ready for her to eat. And she sees that that Ryuji has done all this. She launches the pillow that she carried out with her from bed at him, and has this funny little quip where she sort of snaps at him and she's like, I hope you haven't marked your territory here, you mangy mutt, or you mongrel. Like, she's like, no, you're not a dog. You don't deserve that type of good nickname. You're a mongrel or a mutt. And I thought that was a really funny little exchange, and the back and forth they have during this situation. She sits down at the dining table, starts eating without doing the standard, you know, thank you for the food acknowledgement that always happens in Japan. And she smashes through a little bit more back and forth between her and Ryuji. But then sort of the episode comes to an end here where we find out her sniffles are already gone because the apartment is so clean. And then the last scene we get before the ending cuts to credits is that the envelope has been used to plug the hole that that Tiger put in the wall at Ryuji's apartment with her wooden katana. So that's where episode one of Toradora ends. What was your overall feelings with the episode, Paul? Like, you enjoyed it, thumbs up, thumbs down. Let's talk about maybe, have you got a favorite scene or a favorite moment? What did you think about episode one of Toradora?
So I really enjoyed, like, it had enough in it that it caught my interest and curiosity, as I mentioned throughout. Yeah, so it's like, seems like sort of like the mysteries of sort of like Tiger, like what's up with her living situation. Early on, our two main characters have got some interesting personality traits and they're interacting with each other. Yeah, it's always fun seeing, you know, two people sort of clash and in fun ways. Seeing some of the like high energy sort scenes with Tiger as well. Like it's well animated. Like I couldn't say like there's any bad places there. And yeah, like I got really invested and I smashed out this season. Like yeah, this anime in 3 days. So
I love that. That's a hell of an effort. So yeah, I don't really need to ask the question if you're going to continue watching because it seems you've done that and then some and watched the entire season. Non-spoiler, what was your overall takeaways? Like what was your vibe and feeling as a whole once you rolled credits on that 25th episode?
My vibes is like, I'm glad like a lot of the other characters like in the first couple episodes, like the secondary characters as we saw, like Minori, Kitamura. Sorry. it's like at first they seem very like shallow as characters, but as the series goes on, they develop more like other traits and get more involved in the story. Yeah, like enjoying all the characters. Even like Minori, I felt was really bland throughout the whole thing. But then, like when I sat down, and really thought about it, it's like because at first I thought she has no negative traits, and I'm not gonna say anything like that, but like anything to spoil anything. But no, it's like she does have a negative trait. It's just like it just some people might not see it as sort of negative. If like I might like I'll probably talk to you about this how we spoil things, but I would say like yeah, the characters are very good. They're interesting. They have strengths. They have flaws. They're not just perfect, like sort of little cutouts.
Yeah, and I think that's the sign of good constructed storytelling where. Yeah, like you don't want to watch something where everybody's perfect and flawless and you can't critique them apart from, yep, they're the prettiest, they're the smartest, they're the funniest or whatever else. Like, so I like that there is flaws and realness to that main cast and even some of the supporting cast you meet down the line. Like they don't, they've all got, you know, something I said earlier, they've all got sort of a bit of roughness around the edges, which I could really relate to and I could really sort of empathize and feel for these characters and the situations they go through.
Yeah, very much so. And then, like, you do have, like, you have those just sort of heart-wrenching moments throughout the series where you just go, like, you get those feels where it's, like, a character might say something that they may not admit, like mean to admit to at the time or, like, so, like it's very much because this, it is very much that story of the two characters realizing their feelings over a long time, which is really funny with the first couple of episodes and even actually throughout the whole series, I guess, is sort of the play on characters of like sort of everyone else knows but them.
Yeah, I do like that. Yeah, like, everyone in their greater orbit is sort of aware of what's happening, but the two leads are so oblivious to what's sort of playing out right in front of them. So it's such good storytelling. I'm such a sucker for romance and when they can weave in comedy with that and also sort of that young romance. Like a lot of people know how awkward and difficult schooling can be and when you're throwing feelings and emotions into that mix as well. It makes for a interesting experience. So yeah, it's relatable in a way. It's heartfelt. It's funny. There's some drama. There is some tear jerk moments, which got me good every single time I've watched this series through. Did you have a favorite scene or a moment that stood out in the first episode that was one of your favorites, you'd say?
I guess like the favorite moment is just sort of the bedroom invasion where she comes in, attacks him, and then the like sort of cute little moment as they, it's like he gives, like shows her little, shows him, he shows her his secrets. And then like cute sort of little moments where she's like fumbling, where it's like, well, it's like, can you help me with the love letter and stuff as well. So it's like, again, nice little action scene, but then you get like the cute moments where like she fumbles around a little bit and she's embarrassed.
Yeah, it's very sweet. And yeah, shout out to anyone that might have a, like maybe calling it a box of shame is too harsh, but you know, like a box of love, a box of romance, a box of crushes.
Obviously I can't say for everyone, but I feel like most people have, like, especially when you're young, you've probably sat there and thought about your love future in some way. Maybe not written in and put into a box, but you've thought about it. Like, you went, it's like, if I could just get my crush to, you know, go on a date with me, we'll do this. And then it's like, this is what our future might be like if she just said yes or something like that. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah, you just get caught up in the grandeur of love and the perfect heart-filled future that you might have with your crush or your potential romantic obsession. So yeah, that's probably my favorite scene in this episode as well. If you're still on the fence about whether Toradora is for you, if you're a fan of anime such as Lovely Complex, Chunibyo, Other Delusions, The Familiar Zero, or Clannad, if you've loved any of those, you will love Toradora. They are the most recommended or compared animes on my anime list when you're looking at Toradora and its equivalents. If you liked any of those ones I just mentioned, there's a pretty goddamn high chance you will like Toradora. But Paul, let's move into the last word presented by our friends over at Japan Crate. Experience Japan and through snacks and knickknacks via monthly package drops courtesy of japancrate.com. And while you're there, be sure to use code 8bit15 at checkout to save yourself 15% and get free postage anywhere on planet Earth. So Paul, what is your last word or words on Toradora?
A must watch. Yeah, I think we've sung its praises enough. Really glad out of the four selections you gave me, like this was definitely, like, I'm really glad that I chose this one. As I said, it's a perfect bite-sized anime, which has an ending, because as I was mentioned before, it's not even like the long ending ones, but some animes that just get cut too short before they can even finish. So yeah, I'm just glad this anime, it has a start, it has an ending. You'll be satisfied with where it goes. Yeah, characters are well written in my opinion. Like, you know, animation and art style are good. It's not on the quality of, say, Violet Evergarden. But it's like, I think, like, different time and year and just budget. But no, like, it is really good.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm in lockstep with everything you just said now. Like, yeah, this is an anime that was first released 15 years ago or so at the moment. So yeah, the animation doesn't quite hold up to, say, some of the stuff that you see watching, you know, Demon Slayer at the moment and things like that. But JC Staff, the studio behind Toradora, they've got some pedigree. They've done a lot of anime that I adore, like Food Wars, which I obsess over. Is It Wrong to Try and Pick Up Girls in a Dungeon, which I obsess over. They've done second season of One Punch Man, and they've done, you know, stuff like A Certain Scientific Railgun and all the spin-offs of that franchise as well. So they've got some pedigree, and the animation's great. The story's great. The characters are great. The opening song, absolute friggin' banger, gets the toes tapping, gets you in a good vibe, good times.
Actually, I was disappointed when the second one came along. They did their second opening. I was like, I missed a banger.
Yeah, I don't understand. Like, I know that typically they do that when there's a bit of a tonal shift or progression in a story with an anime, but it was weird to me that they used Pre-Parade for the first 16 episodes, and then from episode 17 through to, you know, the final, they used another song called Silky Heart, which is fine, but it's nowhere near as good as the original. Yeah. Like, Pre-Parade's a banger.
Yeah, no.
But, overall, I'm in a complete agreement with Paul. It's a must-watch. It's fun. It's one of my favorite rom-coms, or if you just want to say one of my favorite anime-based romances that that I've ever watched. It's really enjoyable, and yeah, you get a full, complete story. It's not rushed. It's not underdone. It is like you know, the small bear in like the small bear's porridge. Like, it is just right. Like, Goldilocks would be all up in this Toradora-shaped porridge. So check it out. It is hard to find if you're an Australian listener. It's primarily on Crunchyroll and Funimation. But it's not on Crunchyroll AU. It's on Funimation AU, I believe. It was on Netflix for a while. It's been taken off, so you've got to try and hunt it down where you can. But it's well worth the hunt because it is a banger. But, Paul, that brings us to the end of another episode of More Than Hentai. Thank you so much for stopping on by and sharing your thoughts on Toradora. One last time, where can listeners find you? What have you got coming up? Anything else you want to shout out before we close this studio down?
Mostly you can find me on Twitter at Thundermace AUS, Thundermace AUS. Occasionally you find me on Twitch, but I'm very unreliable. So it's just like, so maybe, yeah, if you subscribe and you see the notification, you're like, yeah, I might have a chat with him. It's like, yeah, come in. And YouTube, occasionally I just post some like gameplay footage, which is mostly right now is Hunt Showdown. I eventually put up there just more or less ago. Look at some fun kills I got. So, like I said, very casual, just sort of like, I mostly do this stuff to go, hey, look, friends, look at what I did today.
I love that. Yeah, listeners, certainly go look at what Paul did today. Check out Thundermace. Just chuck that in any good old search and you'll be able to find him on Twitter, be able to find him on Twitch, you'll be able to find him on YouTube and see all that good stuff. You can find me at Brendan 8-Bit. You can find 8-Bit as a whole at We Are 8-Bit. But yeah, be sure to rate, view, subscribe this podcast and all the other podcasts you listen to on the regular. If you want to get some merchandise, head over to shop8bit.net or check out videogamesandculture.com. But whether your anime be subbed, dubbed, or still yet to come, enjoy yourself, stay hungry, and much love to all the gorgeous waifus out there. Goodbye.